This is Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide. Today on the show, Robert Jensen, music by Sarah Marlowe and Resident Antihero, and a cut from Derek Jensen. This is Rage, building a community of resistance, one podcast at a time. Hello and welcome to Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide, coming to you from occupied Amiskwisi, Wisconsin. I'm your host, Seymour Life. And a special hello to all those building a community of resistance every day. Today's show is on community, collapse, and despair. And my guest today is Robert Jensen. Robert Jensen is a professor of journalism at the University of Austin, Texas. He's an author, activist, and feminist. And as usual, I start by asking him to describe himself.
I'm a former journalist turned professor. I have a specific interest in training in questions of freedom of expression and ethics in the context of media and democracy. But my interests are much wider, beginning with grounding in feminism, especially what's typically called radical feminist critiques of men's violence, concerns about race and white supremacy, about American imperialism and the predatory nature of capitalism, and increasingly a lot of time focused on trying to come to terms with the reality of the multiple ecological crises we face. All of that sort of defines me, I suppose.
Your article, The Anguish of the Age, Emotional Reactions to Collapse. One, how are you describing or how are you thinking of collapse? And then the second one is what prompted you to write the article?
Well, I think, you know, collapse conjures up for people too often some sort of science fiction image of all of the world falling apart in a short time. I think that's especially true given how much attention there's been to reactionary right-wing Christian concerns about apocalyptic revelation, rapture. And so my own view is that we're actually in collapse, that the ecosystem itself is in a state of collapse because of human intervention, and that process will probably accelerate, not coming to some, you know, grand end, but a slow process of degradation. So when I think about collapse in terms of the ecosystem, I think about the steady erosion of topsoil in the United States, for instance. I think about the buildup of toxic waste in the world, both on land and in the oceans. I think of the changes in the hydrological cycle that make clean water more and more difficult to find in different parts of the world. And of course, climate disruption, climate change, global warming, call it what you like. But I think that, in a sense, we are in collapse, and the speed and intensity of that collapse will vary from place to place, and it's not something we can predict. We can just recognize that we're in that state. In his new book, Bill McKibben actually thinks that the planet has changed so dramatically that we should give it a new name. So his new book is titled Earth, with two A's, E-A-A-R-T-H, simply signaling that this collapse has produced a radically different planet than the one on which civilization arose, and the future means, you know, coming to terms with it.
So what prompted you to write the article?
Well, over the last few years, as I've been giving talks on a variety of subjects, whether it's race or gender and pornography or the war or media, I've tried to speak more bluntly about the reality that whatever our interest in political movements for justice within the human family, we have to be aware of this systemic collapse, the way in which human intervention has changed the nature of the ecosystem. And when I first started talking about that, I was afraid people would think I was crazy. And I quickly realized that what was on my mind was on the minds of a lot of people, certainly not the majority of this country or the majority of the world. But for those people who are politically engaged, I think this question of these cascading ecological crises is very much present. And the more I talk to people about it, the more I realized that people were struggling, because this is not simply a problem in which we have to, you know, roll up our sleeves and get to the solution. This is a condition from which there is, in some sense, no escape. And there is inevitably a kind of emotional reaction to an awareness of that magnitude. And I think the last couple of years, I've just been talking more and more with people about how they're coping. And it struck me that people are loath to talk about this. I hear from people that when they do bring it up, they often are accused of being crazy or, you know, hyperbolic or hysterical. So I just was trying to open up some space for people to talk about what's on their minds without a fear of being called crazy.
Now, maybe these next two questions are kind of the same, but I remember reading in Emma Scott Peck's book, The World Waiting to Be Reborn, Civility Rediscovered. He was sort of comparing emotional pain and physical pain and how we don't, there's a reason why your body hurts when you cut it or when you damage it. And that, so there's emotional pain would be analogous to that. And that in our society today, we spend a lot of time avoiding both physical and emotional pain. Would you agree with that kind of sentiment?
Well, we certainly are a culture that tries to numb pain, whether it's through a sort of fanatic devotion to medicine to cure us of every ill we might have, whether it's through prescription drugs or non-prescription drugs. This is a society that really does try to numb itself. And I think that's, you know, understandable, but an unhealthy instinct. And I think the comparison of physical and emotional pain is very real, because we have bodies and those bodies respond to stimuli. And we also have an emotional life that's every bit as real as our physical life in that sense. Just like our body evolved to feel pain, so we evolved emotionally to be attuned to certain kinds of emotional pain. All of that is just a recognition that we are the animals we are. We're talking about our material being, or those aspects of us that are a little more difficult to pin down. I also think that this is not wholly individual. When we talk about emotional pain or a reaction to the reality of the world around us, I think it's partly individual. It's also partly collective. We are a very social animal. We evolved in very small, tight-knit communities, bands, tribes, different words for them. And so when we feel, I think it's important to remember, we don't just feel alone. We live in a highly individualistic culture in which, especially the economy, tries to fragment us and think of ourselves, get us to think of ourselves as purely individual. But I think part of what's going on here is also a kind of collective pain, a pain that's difficult to feel collectively because we are so isolated and fragmented in the culture. But I think that's part of what's going on too.
Do you see a danger in the fact that we're not dealing with that emotion? What do you think those dangers are?
Yeah, it's extremely dangerous. I mean, anytime human beings don't acknowledge reality, that we get in trouble. I think, you know, we're talking about emotional pain. And first of all, let me be clear here. I'm not talking about emotional pain in the way that the therapeutic culture deals with it, as, you know, simply mental states, emotional states that can be somehow corrected easily, that can be diagnosed. You know, we live in a therapeutic culture that treats our emotional states, I think, in very superficial ways often. So I'm talking about something much deeper, a kind of a reaction to that reality of the world. And I think that pain, if we ignore it, means that we're ignoring reality. And I think one sees that in the denial of the dominant culture, the way that people scurry to avoid this. And well, how do they avoid it? Well, some of them avoid it literally through numbing themselves with drugs or alcohol or cheap food or spectacle entertainment, or, you know, the various ways we can avoid it. And those are not healthy, I think. People avoid it sometimes, you know, by shopping. They do all sorts of things. And those are all essentially ways of avoiding what at some level, I think, viscerally in our bodies we know, which is that the larger ecosystem is in collapse. And as long as we deny that and ignore that sense of a kind of shared pain, then we'll never be able to deal with the nature of the systems that have produced this collapse. We'll never be able to deal politically with them. We'll never be able to deal economically, socially, culturally. I think if we don't open up to this sense of pain, I think it just sort of nails the coffin lid shut a little tighter. And I don't think we're going to get out unless we're honest like this.
No, I like that, because it's something that I think myself personally, when talking with other people about this, has been one of those things that keep coming up against, is that whole sense, one, that we're, our emotions, it's a shared thing, but also the whole idea that we're not dealing with it well, and there's a lot of avoidance of actually dealing with the issue.
I think one way to think about this is that traditionally in this culture, emotions are treated as something, you know, kind of fleeting and hard to pin out. But in a way, emotion is also a form of knowledge. Hmm. When we react emotionally, there's often a lot of knowledge built into that emotional reaction. Some of this is obvious. When you react with fear to a threat, mm-hmm. that's not just an emotion. There's information bound up in that. And I think that's true. The fear that we feel is telling us something. And it's folly to ignore information. Anytime an individual or a society ignores any kind of information, it's probably going to end badly. And that's essentially, I think, what we're doing.
I always think of Easter Island when you're talking about that, how, you know, the whole avoidance of the reality, and then the fact that they actually did cut down the last tree and they knew exactly what they were doing when they did it. It's
On a much larger scale, in a sense, that's what we're doing. And and in some ways, we're kind of trapped. I mean, we know, for instance, that if we keep extracting coal, oil, and natural gas from the earth and burning it, we're hastening our own demise. We also know that we live in a system that's utterly dependent on coal, oil, and natural gas. If we stop digging that fossil fuel today, much of the infrastructure of our society would grind to a halt and people would die from it. So, you know, that's the kind of choice we're facing. It's not that we just have to find the right answer, the best solution, the proper path. I think part of what we're talking about here is there is no right solution. There is no proper path. There is no answer. They're simply choosing between a lot of very, very unpleasant alternatives here. Now, one way to look at that is, oh, woe is me, woe are us, and there's nothing that can be done. And in some sense, that's true. I don't think there's anything that can be done to halt the decline. But if that decline is going to go forward, there are choices we have about how to manage it, how to live with it, how to engage each other during the time of that decline. And those are very important choices. They don't necessarily come with easy answers, with solutions, but they come with better and worse options. And I think that's where we should be focused.
My next question deals with this issue of despair, because I think that's something that's come up, and I talk about it in terms of when people actually really start working this through and start, as you've already said, you know, we live in a system totally dependent upon fossil fuels that we've created around us. And if you sit and, you know, you look in a room and you see how much stuff actually comes as a result of that fossil fuel, then suddenly you start to realize, okay, then we're in a much more difficult situation than just put the right light bulbs in, right? That's
right.
Not going to do anything for us. And so one person that we were talking campfire, and one person said, well, talk, but what do we do about despair? Like, is there something to do with it? And I'm not sure that there certainly is something to you can do with the emotion, but it's certainly different, I think, than some of the other emotions that we talk about by being angry or upset about things.
Well, I actually think there's a lot to do if it isn't pointing to some grand and glorious solution to problems.
Right.
For one thing, I think it's good to remember that human beings have long understood that virtue, and I use that in kind of the broad sense, virtue doesn't just float down from the heavens and enter us. It's cultivated. And this goes back to the ancient Greeks, you know, the cultivation of habits and virtue. Anybody who's been a parent knows this. You don't just tell a kid how to behave. You cultivate certain kinds of virtue, and a lot of that's just by doing. Well, I think that a lot of virtues have been kind of cultivated out of us by this high-energy, high-technology, mass-consumption society. And there's a lot we have to learn. And part of that is learning skills. It's, you know, there's a big interest in permaculture and gardening and organic food. You know, all of these things that people recognize are skills that we need to relearn, or for some of us, learn for the first time. And we have to cultivate those habits. But there's also a way of being beyond just acquiring skills that we have to cultivate. And a lot of that is just about what it means to live in real community. A lot of us who are in the more affluent sectors of society don't really live in anything that can be called a real community, and we've got to practice that as well. So just to give you an example, here in Austin, Texas, where I live, a group of us from different kinds of activist and nonprofit groups came together and bought a building. Well, you know, that building is fossil fuel powered and all the same problems we're talking about. But the people who come together in that building are trying to work out a different way of being. And in a sense, what we're doing is practicing a new kind of neighborliness and community. It's pulling together people from disparate backgrounds, some old, some young, some white, some not white, some fairly affluent, some working class and poor, some U.S. citizens, some immigrants, and undocumented immigrants. Okay, so all of a sudden in this building, we're forced to practice, to cultivate some virtues that maybe we've let slide. Well, I think that project, you know, it has lots of specific goals that are attached to the different groups and programs that we're pushing in the space. But I think in some ways the most important part of that overall project, this cultivation of a new kind of relationship and being able to deal with the conflicts that arise in those relationships, that's, to me, that's very political work these days. It's very important work. It doesn't necessarily provide a clear, direct answer when people say, well, what are we supposed to do? But it is doing something. And in the process, we learn, we change course, we find new ways to interact, new programs to pursue. I mean, that's, as far as I'm concerned, that's the best we're going to do right now. Sometimes people come and say to me things like, well, you're against capitalism. Well, give me an alternative. As if you could pull off the shelf a fully developed economic system to replace the system that has essentially dominated the world for the last 200 years. Well, if somebody came and said, well, here, I have a system, an alternative to capitalism that'll work perfectly. If somebody said that to you, the first thing you should do is laugh, because nobody's smart enough to devise such a system. It's going to be through these experiments, these stumbling forward, that I think it's going to happen. And that's, to me, that's what you do with despair. You recognize that nobody's going to hand you an answer to despair. You have to, you know, you have to work at it. A lot of people say to me, well, where's the hope in what you're talking about? And I say, well, hope isn't something that somebody gives you. Hope isn't something somebody else hands to you. I think hope is something you earn, and you earn it individually and collectively by proving yourself competent and worthy of that hope. And that's really what I think people have to see, is that no program that somebody might sketch for you, no book you're going to read, no political ideology that you might adopt is going to provide that hope. That hope is going to come from recognizing the path we're on is disastrous, and carving out some new path that is not going to be clear. It's, you know, it's not going to be a paved road. It's going to be a muddy struggle, but that's our fate. You know, that's the cards we got dealt. In life, you play the cards you got dealt. You don't speculate about what life would be if it was a different deck.
That actually reminds me of in the Lord of the Rings movie, the first movie. There's a point in which they're in the Mines of Moria and they don't know which way to go. And Frodo sits there and sort of complaining about having the ring and things like that. And Gandalf says, Frodo says, I wish the ring had never come to me. And Gandalf says, yeah, well, so do all who live to see such times. But it's not the right term. It's not how much time we have. It's what we do with the time that we have that matters. Or not, yeah, not the time in which we live, but it's what we do with the time that we have that matters. And sort of, it reminded me of the same thing. He says, it's not, we kind of deal with what we have in front of us and our avoidance of that, or even our avoidance of the realities that we live within. Trying to hope that we have all aces rather than realizing that we got the worst cards, maybe. at this point. Yeah. I know that you mentioned earlier also, too, that you deal with, you talk about privilege. And one of the things that I was going to ask you, and I know you touched on that, what some of what one of your, that you do with your group there on that, but I wanted to sort of, how do you think that privilege does affect our emotions? And when you mentioned one point that we are actually, those that are affluent are much more fractured than those that aren't. How does privilege affect our emotions, and how does it affect our relationship to the collapse that we're seeing?
Well, I think privilege, and we can use that kind of in a general sense, anybody who has a kind of unearned status, unearned power, unearned resources, by virtue of some hierarchy. There's lots of different kinds of privilege. I happen to have a lot of privilege by virtue of being, you know, white and male and a U.S. citizen and educated and holding a professional job and a lot of autonomy. You know, I'm one of the most privileged people on the planet. You know, short of being independently wealthy, you know, I have everything I can imagine. My observation, having been around a lot of privileged people in my life, is that privilege tends to, not in every case, but it tends to make people, in a sense, weak. It tends to cultivate a sense of entitlement. I think everybody can observe that people who have a lot of privilege get used to it and start to believe that that is, in fact, what they're entitled to. Well, that's the worst possible approach to living in a time of collapse, because those entitlements are going to start to disappear. And if you believe that that's somehow your birthright, you're going to be ill-equipped to deal with the reality in front of you. And you're going to be especially ill-equipped to cooperate with others, because you're going to spend a lot of your time trying to figure out how to get back what you think you have coming to you, instead of looking at the world as it is and saying, how can I cooperate with others to make the best of what we have together? And I think privilege in that sense, it blinds people to the reality of oppression, hierarchy, injustice in front of them, but it also leaves people ill-equipped to deal with difficult times. You know, I think some of the most privileged people that I've met are some of the most useless people in the world when push comes to shove. I always make jokes about faculty at major universities. I work at a large university. The faculty, extremely privileged. The gift of doing interesting work and being well paid for it with very few demands placed on you. I mean, the life of a university faculty member is incredibly privileged. And I think pound for pound, faculty members are the whiniest, most self-indulgent people on the planet, and often the most selfish, quite frankly. I'm constantly struck by how difficult it is to get faculty to move outside of their own self-interest, for instance. Well, why is that? Well, I think it's mostly because of privilege. Well, that's something that's got to be overcome. And for people with privilege who are accustomed to thinking of themselves as having all the answers and being the smartest people in the room, one of the most important things we have to do is recognize that, in fact, it is the people with less privilege who probably have the most to offer. Again, to try and make this concrete, I certainly see that day in and day out in this project at our building, where I'm often working with construction workers, immigrant workers, some of whom don't speak English, some of whom don't have papers, and who are more useful than I could ever be. They have skills that I don't have. They have often a capacity for work that I don't have anymore, that I've lost. And instead of looking at them and thinking, well, look at all the things I can do that they can't do, you know, intellectually or in writing or whatever, I look at them and I think, my God, I wish I were them. I wish I had some of the virtues they have. Right. And that leads me to want to work with them, to try and learn from them, to contribute where I can. I've learned I'm not bad with a broom and a mop. You know, I haven't swept floors and mopped floors in a long time. University faculty are not expected to mop floors and sweep floors. But in this building, I've realized, well, I can't do some of the more guild labor, but I can do that. And that may seem kind of silly, but it's actually been a kind of nice part of the project. But to do that, you have to let go of that sense of entitlement. You have to let go of that sense that you're always the smartest person in the room, because nobody is always the smartest person in the room, even the really smart folks.
I know that you've done a lot of work on the issue of masculinity, and I'm wondering where that fits into this discussion that we're having. And if you can sort of tie that, maybe tie that in, or is it the same as the privilege question that I asked?
Well, I think masculinity is a good place to test out some of this and to recognize the complexity and often the contradiction. So, of course, we still live in a patriarchal culture, a culture dominated not only by men, by specific men, but dominated by values and assumptions that come out of male culture. We live in a hierarchical culture, and the foundation of that hierarchy is patriarchy. And men develop a sense of entitlement. You see it all the time in all aspects of life. Men become blind to the privilege they have and often to the injustice around them. All that's true. It's also true that men are some of the most fearful and kind of vulnerable people in the world, because that sense of domination within the hierarchy is so illusory and so shaky that it produces a real kind of crisis in masculinity. Well, all of this is true. The system is what it is. It's patriarchal, it's male dominant, it's abusive and oppressive. Men within that system have an enormous amount of unearned privilege and power. And it's also true that men are in a constant state of crisis about it. Okay, well, that's the world we live in. All of these systems are kind of fraying in similar ways. You see it around race. You see it around economic injustice and wealth. You see it around U.S. imperial power. All of this alleged strength and power, we're learning, is based on a house of cards. And that house of cards comes down card by card, and the crisis around it is palpable. That's why I think you're seeing a backlash of more overt racism than ever in my lifetime in the United States, as, you know, the white dominant white society starts to recognize the illusory nature of its power. Certainly seeing it around the role of the United States in the world, a kind of almost psychotic backlash trying to reestablish this notion of the United States as the most powerful and important nation in the history of the planet. I mean, all of this unfolding, and that's partly what makes it such a dangerous time. I think if we were sane, all of us in these positions of privilege would be saying, okay, it's now clear that this privilege is unearned, this power is dangerous, and the whole system out of which it comes is, you know, a shell game. And how do we create a different kind of world? But unfortunately, that's not always the path people choose. Sometimes people choose to try and shore up that illusory power and reestablish that dominance. And, you know, that's really, I think, the choice. If we choose to recognize the profound injustice that these systems have produced, we have a chance. But if we scurry to reassert that injustice and power and privilege and dominance, then I think as a species we're done. I think we will dig our own grave in increasingly quick shovel strokes. And that's the choice. Sitting here, no one can predict which path we're going to take. The immediate situation does not look particularly promising, as so much of the United States, the society I focus on, obviously, when so much of that society seems to be scurrying to maintain a system that cannot be maintained, to hold on to power that can't be held on to. One isn't particularly upbeat when you look at the United States, but of course, you know, the game isn't over yet, and still time for those of us trying to chart a different path to continue that work.
So one of the debates that I often have with people sometimes is that, and it's around the concept of Joe Public, and then on top of that is the just a recent article I saw about facts don't matter. Now, people won't make change or won't change their minds or won't believe facts until they actually have, they're in an actual interactive, you know, where they're actually manually doing something or in an interactive environment where they'll actually see the results of the facts in some way or other, that they will not accept that kind of thing. And that's where I wonder, I think that's where I start to really despair, is that whole sense that you're not really going to be able to convince a large number of people that we really need to make this change.
Well, I think more people than we might realize know the basic facts of the world and do want to make the change. I think the problem right now is that people don't have a place to talk through what that means. Let me give you an example. you know, I give a lot of talks, often on campuses, sometimes in community groups, and I usually try to articulate a pretty radical analysis. And when I first started doing that, I thought people were going to think I was crazy. And what I found is the people, at least the people who come to events that I'm part of, are not resistant to that kind of radical analysis. Often, in fact, they're grateful to hear it because it echoes something they've been thinking, even if they haven't articulated it in the same way. And here's something that happens very routinely. People will come up and talk to me after a lecture or after an event, and they'll be, you know, really excited, and they'll say, I want to do X, or I want to bring this into my company, or I want to bring this to my campus, or I want people like you to come to my class, and I'm going to contact you, and I want to follow up on this. And there's all this energy. And, you know, and I try to be encouraging, but I also know that about 90% of the people who say that to me, I'll never hear from again. And the reason I think is pretty simple is in that moment, they're excited. They're around like-minded people. They feel support for the stirrings in their own heart and their own head. But the next day, they go back to work. They go back to the company they work for, the college they work at, wherever it is. And they're going to find that support isn't there. And it's very difficult to make it on your own in that sense. It's very difficult to go up against the system day in and day out and argue and resist. And I think people, understandably, even when they know that a different path is required, it's simply difficult to do it on your own. And so, you know, a lot of times people say to me, well, it's all talk, you know, when are we going to get to action? And I think one of the things we have to realize right now that talking is a form of action, that standing up in conventional spaces and being willing to talk about a radical analysis, whether it's of race or gender or economics or ecology, that just doing that is important because there are people who want to hear it, who need to be reinforced in their own thinking and feel isolated. And the degree to which we can break down that isolation is very important. And I think that's what we should be doing all the time. You know, to give you another example, I joined a church about 5 years ago, even though I don't have what anyone would call conventional Christian beliefs. I don't believe in the supernatural claims about gods and risen lords and such things. But I did join a very conventional denomination, a Presbyterian church, but it's a church where people are thinking quite differently. And I have been hammering away at that church on some of these issues, often getting resistance from other members of the congregation. But over time, I can see that it's had an effect, not because everybody believes what I believe, but because people who I think were trying to find their way have now a space where these ideas are part of the discussion. Again, doesn't mean everybody agrees with everybody, but it's a space where people know they can come and engage like that. And that's the kind of spaces we have to create. I don't care if it's in a school or a university or a church or a company or a community group, whatever. Wherever we are, that kind of talking is a very important part of our action agenda. And, you know, I think people sometimes cynically say, well, that's just all talk. And I think part of the reason they say that is because they don't want to talk themselves. They're afraid of where that talking might lead. You know, you talk too long about critique and resistance, and eventually you find yourself doing it. And that's, for a lot of people, a very dangerous and scary thought. So simply voicing what one knows in one's head and one's heart is, at this point, I think, as important as anything.
In your sermon, I read it on the Energy Bulletin, you say, if we can watch, and in this case, you're talking about the human betrayal of creation play out and not feel anguish, then we have surrendered our own humanity. To be human today, to be fully alive, is to embrace that anguish. I see no other choice. And then you also go on to say, we cannot know what lies ahead. We can only love and act. No matter what lies ahead, we can always rejoice. We can always pray without ceasing. Can you explain why you feel that way, thought process there?
First of all, the use of the language, you know, talking about creation, talking about prayer. I want to be clear, when I talk about creation, I don't mean I think there's a creator out there that, you know, God put together the earth and threw it out into space. I think words like creation convey a sense of the sacred, a sense of reverence for all around us. And I use them, guardedly and sometimes with some hesitation, because I know people take them in different ways. But that's an important sort of footnote to that passage. When I talk about prayer, for instance, I don't mean praying to God to change things or give me wisdom. I mean prayer is a sense of commitment to a practice of self-reflection and engagement. And so in that particular sermon, I talked about that rejoice always, pray without ceasing. I always love that couplet. And it reminds us that rejoice always, that even in the darkest time, we're human, we're alive, we have the capacity to feel joy. It doesn't mean that in every moment we feel joyful. There's a lot of moments when that joy is very hard to find. And you can see historically all sorts of moments that seemed, you know, beyond hope. But eventually I think we come around and reclaim that joy. And at the same time, we pray without ceasing. We remain committed to the hard work of self-reflection and engagement. And I think that's essentially the human condition. Rejoice always and pray without ceasing. And you see that articulated in all sorts of different ways. Another version of that I find very powerful comes from Wendell Berry, the novelist, poet, critic, kind of the poet laureate of the sustainable agriculture movement. And in Wendell Berry's, one of his early books, he talked about the human estate of grief and joy. He said, you know, that's what we live on, the human estate of grief and joy. And there is no escape from the grief. It is part of being human in the world. And it would be overwhelming if not for the joy. And I think that notion that this is our fate, we're, you know, an animal like all other animals living in an ecosystem, but we do have this particularly peculiar capacity for self-awareness, for self-reflection, consciousness, and a well-developed linguistic ability to convey it. Well, that's, as we always like to say, that's a blessing and a curse, and we better get used to it. And I think a lot of the best wisdom and the best literature and art of us, of our species, is an attempt to, you know, work that out, to always remind ourselves that it is grief and joy, it is rejoice always and pray without ceasing. And one just footnote, and that we will always fail. You know, no one can pray without ceasing. The biblical admonition is unattainable. It's simply what we strive. It's again, you know, the kind of quirky reality of being human. As far as we know, no other animal fusses as much about its own state of being as the human, and that's just what we are.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your taking the time.
Thanks. This was a very interesting, you sort of took me through it in a new way, so I enjoyed it. Yeah.
Oh, good.
I always like it when I have to think and say it somewhat differently. So, good.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Glad
good.
We were able to do it.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it very much. Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Make you do such crazy things. Try to find something to bring me peace. It's times like these when the questions fly endlessly. Some other place. If we can change, well, then maybe we'll just have to escape. Why stand still when you can always run away? Sometimes some things are easier just not to face. Tell me some. feeling I just can't seem to shake. The more I try to dream, the more it feels the same. Am I losing perspective or just losing my mind? When is it time?
Was Sarah Marlowe with Fall Down on My Knees. One of the things I really take away from my discussion with Bob Jensen is the idea that not only do we need to deal with these emotions on an individual level, but also on a collective or community level. That as a community, we need to heal ourselves in the emotional sense. Especially when dealing with things like despair and the issue of collapse. And the other thing I totally take away from is the fact that we need to relearn what community is. And so when we talk about building a community of resistance, when we talk about building these pieces and parts of what a community of resistance is, one of the things is that it is a place to heal as well as much as a place to act from. And through both healing and acting, I think that we go forward with actually building what that community is. And we build a stronger foundation for it to grow. Especially like, too, the idea that, you know, he's very good at pushing a broom and mopping. And I think this is another important part of what building a community of resistance is taking on all the roles or taking on roles that are important and understanding that pushing the broom and mopping is an important function within a community as hammering a nail or writing the propaganda or any of those other things, that we need all parts of the community and we need to start really talking about all the parts that we need to putting them into place so that we have that foundation to really grow and build on. Since one of the people's responses quoted Derek Jensen on despair, and the piece that I asked Derek if I could use the piece from his CD, Now This War Has Two Sides, on despair, and he said that I could. I really wanted to include that because I think that there are some very good points there. And Derek comes out and says very similar to what Robert talked about, and by the way, they're not related, in being able to hold these two concepts within our hearts and minds that, one, we're really fucked, and two, life is really good. And Derek says this really quite well. So we'll just go right into that clip, and we'll be taken out by Resident Antihero with Necropolis. We need a community of resistance, and that community needs you. Thank you for listening, and have a good night.
So, a few years ago, a friend of mine called me up late at night, and she said, she's an environmental activist, works on toxics issues, and she called me up and she said, I can't take it anymore. This work's just killing me. It's breaking my heart. I said, yeah, it'll do that. She said, dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does, even itself. She said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does. She said, unless it's stopped, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is, unless it's stopped. And then she said, we're not going to make some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? I thought a moment, and then I said the thing I knew all along was the best thing I could say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason I knew that was the best thing I could say is because about 12 years ago now, I was undergoing a similar collapse where I was just bursting into tears several times a week over the death of the salmon, kootenai, sturgeon, Selkirk caribou, bull trout. And a lot of my environmentalist friends said, Derek, just take some time off. The problem's still be there when you come back. And I knew I couldn't do that. I knew, if you're not going to cry about the death of the salmon, what are you going to cry about? What if you're not going to cry about global warming, what do tears mean? And I knew I had to just keep pushing through. And one day, I called up this friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong. She's an Okanagan Indian writer and activist. I was crying. And I said to her, this work's killing me. It's breaking my heart. She said, yeah, it'll do that. I said, dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does, even itself. I said, it has death urge, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does. I said, unless it stops, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? She said, yeah, it is, unless it stopped. I said, we're not going to make some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And she said the best thing she could possibly say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best thing she could possibly say is because it normalized my despair and let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. It let me know that sorrow is just sorrow and pain's just pain. And it's not so much my sorrow or even pain that hurts as it is my resistance to it. It let me know that I could feel all of those things and it wouldn't kill me. And there's this idea that if you really acknowledge how bad things are, you have to go around being miserable all the time. But the truth is, I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart the understanding that we are really, really fucked. And that life is really, really good. And that we are so fucked. And that life is so good. You know, some people have said to me, so if things are so bad, why don't you just kill yourself? And I always respond, because I'm having a good time. There's this great Irish proverb, is this a private fight or can anybody join? And I love that. And another one I get is, if things are so bad, why don't you just party? And the answer is, I don't really like parties. And I realize that that question, if things are so bad, why don't you just party? I realize that question reveals nothing more nor less than an incapacity to love. Because if you're in love, you act to defend your beloved. That's what you do. Oh, yeah. This person wrote to me a couple years ago, and she wanted to know how my anger at the dominant culture affects my sex life. And I was so tempted to write back, that is a question to which you will never know the answer. I realized that her question is based on the idea that anger is a shotgun, that if you're angry, you're angry. But the truth is, I'm really angry at the things that make me angry, and I'm not angry at the things that don't make me angry. My anger at Weyerhaeuser or at Charles Hurwitz doesn't spill over onto my friends. So we can feel all those things. And there's an even better thing about feeling all those things and realizing that it won't kill you, which is you can feel all those things and you realize it does kill you. And there's a wonderful thing about being dead, which is once you're dead, they can't touch you anymore. You can still sing and you can still dance and you can still make love and you can still fight like hell, but they can't touch you. Not with threats, not with promises, not with anything.
cold as concrete, don't nothing survive. Chemicals pollute, machines keep you alive. Machines keep you alive. Chemicals pollute, machines keep you alive. In this cold ass concrete, don't nothing survive. Chemicals pollute, machines keep you alive. Machines keep you alive. Chemicals pollute, machines keep you alive. You don't kill your own meat, you use air conditioned heat. Third world sweatshops, keep the shoes on your feet. Domestically adapted, held captive, active. Theory and practice, telephones and faxes. Microwave generation, push for in demand. You no longer feel the warmth of the soil in your hand. The food that you eat is processed in a can. Internet access, nanosecond attention span. You ain't got no connection to your animal senses. The trees that you see are planted behind fences. Manicured existence, denial of the real, buried in the concrete, crushed beneath the wheel. In this cold ass concrete, don't nothing survive. Chemicals pollute, machines keep you alive. Machines keep you alive. Chemicals pollute, machines keep you alive. In this cold ass concrete, don't nothing survive. Chemicals pollute, machines keep you alive. Machines keep you alive. Chemicals pollute, machines keep you alive. We lived differently before the days of empires. Killing our food and staring into the fire. The air we used to breathe wasn't diseased. No bank account money, no parking lot fees. In the bosom of Mother Nature until we tried to rape her. Now we're the only species that kills for pieces of paper. Not even paper anymore, invisible credit numbers. Accumulating in savings accounts for oil and lumber. City of the dead, concrete necropolis. Civilized zombies manifest apocalypse. Four horsemen riding through the streets of depraved. Skyscraper tombstones, you live inside your grave. This cold ass concrete, don't nothing survive. Chemicals pollute, machines keep you alive. Machines keep you alive. Chemicals pollute, machines keep you alive. In this cold ass concrete, don't nothing survive. Chemicals pollute, machines keep you alive. Machines keep you alive. Chemicals pollute, machines keep you alive. The human animal has lost touch with its roots. Segregated and separated into groups. Food, clothes, and shelter to the extreme. Society was born, welcome to the machine. Science was created to destroy the mystery. Cities were built and we forgot the history. Emotional divorce from the natural force. Purchasing product that the machine will endorse. Further we detach, the further we go fall. Feeding the machines, shopping at the mall. Electric stoves, pantyhose, things you don't need. Creatures of comfort, creating a new breed. Completely saturated by a culture of greed. Selling your children to machines that don't bleed. In this cold ass concrete, don't nothing survive. Selling your children to machines that don't bleed. In this cold ass concrete, don't nothing survive. Selling your children to machines that don't bleed. In this cold ass concrete, don't nothing survive. Selling your children to machines that don't bleed. In this cold ass concrete, don't nothing survive.